Donald in the kitchen talks about food. Donald in the kitchen talks recipes. Donald in the kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donald in the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We gather here around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming advice, recipes, and opinions. And we come to you from the studios of KHOI Community Radio in beautiful downtown Ames, Iowa. And we're glad that you have joined us today. Well, I want to mention a little bit about weather. There was a very nasty tornado event in Iowa this last week.
Deadly.
South Central, and we got a tornado, yes siree, in March. I have a report from the Donald in the Kitchen News Department because, like, about an hour after that storm went through, and I did check my radar, it's going to be gone. I was heading south out of Ames, heading for Des Moines, and I noticed, my goodness, it's very dark down there. But boy, did I ever see weather. I did not see a tornado. However, thunder snow and extreme dark clouds to the east, the clouds breaking up in the west. I saw a beautiful sunset setting under the clouds.
Rainbows were spotted.
Over Ankeny. Oh, right, got to Ankeny. There was a rainbow, and get this, there was lightning under the rainbow. So
where's the pot of gold under the rainbow? What's with this lightning? Oh, boy.
We certainly need one. Talk about weather in Iowa. So tornadoes and thunder and snow and lightning and rainbow.
And really intense rain, really.
Oh, my.
It was very colorful. I described the whole thing as rather apocalyptic. The color of the light, it gets orangey and dark and very intense.
We got a little bit of everything all at once. We are glad you can join us at our kitchen table today. So understanding each other can often begin with food. Sharing a meal, sharing a recipe can enrich our lives and connect us in spirit with folks halfway around the world. Some past Donald in the Kitchens, we've started to do some cookbook traveling. There's so many good cookbooks out there, and they're so good to read through. Today, we have some cookbooks to share and some recipes. Today, we visit the Ukraine. Donna, tell us about the cookbooks you found.
Well, you know, we were just thinking, at least for us, the beginning of understanding a culture often is what they eat, because a lot of traditions and cultural habits are surrounded by, you know, families and celebrating together, and it's always with food. We had recently visited with our friend Gio Chiklazi, who does his from Georgia, so we had covered Georgian food. And it's another Caucasus country, and so there's a lot of similarities between, like, in the Ukrainian cookbooks, you get recipes from Azerbaijan and from Georgia, and from, it kind of runs that way. Now, the Ukraine, we have an author that we kind of like. Her name is, how would you pronounce that?
I'd call it Hercules, but it looks like Hercules.
It's spelled like Hercules.
Olia Hercules.
Yeah.
Or Olia Hercules. I don't know. OliaHercules.
And we had been, Lana and I had been sort of captivated by our books. First of all, there's a lot of beautiful pictures in them. And the first book that she wrote is called Mamushka, and she says in the book what Mamushka comes from. This is a very cute story. She says, "My brother Sasha and I watched the Addams Family film for the first time in 1996. She says, "Everything came about 5 years late in post-Soviet Ukraine. At some point during the movie, a bunch of American actors suddenly spoke a made-up Eastern European language and danced the Mamushka, the dance of brotherly love, taught to their family by a Cossack cousin. Our whole family found this part of the film irresistibly hilarious, and since then my brother and I have called our mom Mamushka. So the first book that we have from her is called Mamushka, and it's about just family recipes. Now the second book, because we got hooked on the first one, is called Summer Kitchens, Recipes and Reminiscence from Every Corner of Ukraine. And it is about the tradition of, well, Lonnie, you explain that part.
Okay, summer kitchens are not really just for the summer. It is a place, a little house outside the house, traditionally for food preparation, food preservation, and actually a place for big feasts, because a summer kitchen would probably have at least a gas stove and probably a masonry stove, which was a traditional way of warming the house and warming lots of things. In Ukraine, it's called a peek, P-I-C-H, and it was a masonry stove. It warmed the whole kitchen or the whole house. But this little place would be a place to, butcher chickens, start your chicks out, can your tomatoes, pickle everything, butcher things, prepare things. And actually, summer kitchen was lived in all year round. It was a center for feasts, and most people that lived out in the country have this sort of thing. And one nice thing about this Summer Kitchens book, it has a lot of stories about how traditionally preparing food to keep all year was a very big deal.
Well, and it's not that, I mean, I suspect there are a lot of rural communities, like in the South, summer kitchens were quite common, especially in the country. It was to keep the heat out of the house while you were cooking, mm-hmm. in some ways. And there was even a time in colonial America where the kitchen was actually not in the house. Like if you visit Colonial Williamsburg, you'll see the kitchen is in a separate building. And then the food was run into the big house, you know, by the colored help, basically. But the kitchens, having an external kitchen is I think it's a fabulous idea.
I think it is too. It connected everybody to the outside and great place for, I'll be sharing some stories because this Summer Kitchens book by Olya Herkulis is not just recipes in this book, but has a lot of reminiscences of, life today and as sad as it may be, life today in the Ukraine and how it was not so very long ago. Region of Ukraine, everybody, I think, kind of has to take a step back and say, now where exactly is that country?
It's not small by Eastern European standards.
Right. And we're getting our maps and looking at it, and we find it. Yes, there it is. Oh, and there's Chernobyl, and there's Odessa. Maybe we've heard about that sort of thing. Ukraine, actually, the name Ukrainia comes from a word meaning borderlands, because happens to be kind of in the middle between the east and the west, and ravaging hordes and people were going past and through there over the centuries many, many times. And actually there's a little note here that when the Muslim invaders came back and forth and back and forth, they were actually not as bad as the rest, because at least the Ukrainians said they left us our pigs. They took everything else. But so there were a big history of it being on the border. And the reason this country is fought over a lot, and perhaps even today, it is an amazingly agriculturally rich country.
Yeah, it's you know, everybody's talking about Russian oil and oil prices and yada, wada, wada. But another consequence of this war is going to be, it's going to have a heavy impact on global food systems, because Ukraine and Russia contribute a large percentage of the wheat growing in the whole world and other grains. Now, Ukraine has a very similar climate to Iowa, and There are two places in the world that have this deep, rich, black soil. One is Iowa and the other is the Ukraine. So they have often been compared. Ukraine has, as they say, the remarkable fertile soil, and the grain supply that grows on there is largely imported into Europe and the Middle East. Of course, in America, we have our own grain supply, so we're not like affected about it so much, the same as we are with oil. But the thing is, there are two things. The grain supply, for example, can affect countries like especially in the Middle East that are already kind of very stressed with food supplies and things like that. And if they get their wheat cut off, there will be even greater global instability. The logistics of it, most of the grain in Europe is in Western Russia and, of course, the Ukraine. And a lot of it, if you're looking at the maps of where the Russians are trying to capture, of course, they're going after Kiev, but mostly they're in the south. What they're trying to do is cut off the Black Sea. And they keep saying, okay, probably Odessa will be next because that's the last. They pretty much have already controlled the Black Sea and the entrance is the Sea of Azov. So what's left is Odessa. And the strategic importance of that is most of the grain leaving Russia and the Ukraine goes through the Black Sea. So that is a serious thing for them. Now the other thing, it says that those are the two points of maritime access. So there's 17 ports around Odessa. So this is pretty big deal. Now the other thing the Ukraine is and Russia is that they control huge amounts of natural gas that are needed to promote to produce ammonia and other things like potash and the things that we need to make fertilizers. So fertilizer price has already been high because of the price of natural gas. It is going to get worse. And in particular, we're nearing the spring planting, and which is a big burst of fertilizer is needed. So that could be critical. It's kind of interesting. There are some people sounding sort of optimistic notes saying things like, and it's not impossible, this is a grim way to do it, but as we become aware of the difficulties of living without gas and oil and fertilizers, as a global society, and probably each country in its own way, will be forced to find alternatives, and especially greener alternatives. Now, the problems with fertilizers have as they become more expensive, that will drive farmers to find alternatives, A, to reduce fertilizer use, which in Iowa is a big deal. As we know, it's the cause of, it runs into the Mississippi and goes down and causes the dead zone, and Iowa is the largest contributor to the dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. So there's already been talk of reducing fertilizer use and trying to find out what the minimum amount of conventional fertilizers can do without impacting fertility and yield. So there's ongoing research with that, and that's helpful. The other thing that we've discovered with fertilizers in the last, 10 years, as we've studied more about soil biology and learning more about the millions and billions of, creatures living in our soil, is that the impact fertilizers produced from hydrocarbons, oil, gas, whatever, gas, basically, do have a negative impact on the soil biota. So by having to reduce these kinds of inputs, mainly because they're very expensive, growingly more expensive, and increasingly in some places, especially in Europe, probably will become less and less available, that will encourage further research that has been very productive of finding alternatives to using these kinds of fertilizers. Obviously, using appropriate animal excrements and all the things that organic farmers have been doing for years, because in organic systems, you don't use nitrogen fertilizer at all. So how do you promote soil fertility? Now, people think, oh, we have to go back to the way our great-grandfathers did it. But, you know, the fortunate thing with the advance of more organic farming is a lot of research has been done to improve these things. And a lot is known. It's just going to be hopefully more widely implemented. So keep your eye on, you know, like the Ukraine also produces a lot of corn for Europe, basically, which means, you know, that in the short term could be, and the Russians send it a lot of it to also to China and things like that. So in the short term, this could drive the corn price up, which for Iowa is always a welcome thing, you know. So in addition to, you know, watching the prices at the gas pump, there will be food price increases, particularly in Europe. So that's, you know, that's going to affect all of us.
Well, yes, we're talking resources here. And like Donna said, kind of remember in your mind that Ukraine is not unlike Iowa. Cold in the winter, hot in the summer.
Highly agricultural, fertile.
Very fertile. Here's a little bit of history about the Ukrainian soil. Warmed by the blazing sun, Ukrainian soil is some of the most fertile in the world. It's been called the fertile black soil and black gold. In the 1940s, the Nazis allegedly attempted to transport trainloads of this precious soil back to Germany. Well, we're talking resources here, and there you go. And since the 1990s, following the breakup of the Soviet Union, it's become a black market commodity. So, bags of potting soil, I can see that. I buy potting soil in the spring, and it is a pretty amazing, amazing thing. Let's, when we think about that, this part of the world, the word borscht seems to come up, and there are, I read a lot about borscht recently, and we think of borscht as a soup made out of beets, but
Sweet and sour,
and sometimes it's not beets. So beets are not beets. What about you? Donna?
According to our cookbooks that we're reading, borscht is it's soup. Apparently there's, you know, the red borscht made with beets, and then there's green borscht, and, you know, beets, of course, figure prominently, as does cabbage, and then potatoes. Here's a sorrel broth. And chicken stock or beef stock or even lamb stock, you know, borscht seems to mean soup. Mm. But maybe the sour thing, like one of the recipes said, to make a sour borscht, like for example, if you wanted to do like a very soupy, you know, beef stew with potatoes and that sort of thing, and to make it kind of Ukrainian-ish, put some chopped dill in it, put some sauerkraut juice for the sour element, and then, of course, serve it with sour cream.
Ah, very good. There's a website that we dip into every now and then called The Forager Chef, and he had some things to say about borscht. And he refers to borscht as a plant and soup, because before borscht had beets in it, traditionally in Eastern Europe.
He goes way back into the Middle Ages these recipes and the history of borscht.
He uses the stems of
parsnip,
and hogweed were said to, also with meat in this soup too, but it had a lot of wild grains. Well, maybe they weren't wild at the time, but not necessarily beets. So all sorts of things. And there's a thing called, in Eastern Europe, and I'm finding out more about it by reading some of these nice cookbooks, something called kvass, which is the sour bits of things.
Yeah, there's a lot of fermenting things in her books. She gives this description of kvass.
Kvass is a non-alcoholic Russian fermented rye bread drink. When cold, it can be as refreshing as cider or indeed blonde beer with a slice of lemon in it. It also has an affinity with one of the most ancient drinks known to man, mead, which is a honey ferment. The best kvass is made with natural yeast. The babushka I met at the market made it by mixing hop flowers, like bitters from beer, right? And flour, assuming, you know, either wheat or probably rye, and hot water, which is then rolled into pellets and left to dry in the sun. So then what do you do? Hers is made out of, does she give a recipe in that book?
Well, there's one here for wheat bran and polenta kvass, again, fermenting. And there's an allusion to, yes, it's like kombucha. It's a sour.
That's true. Yeah. That's a good analogy.
And there's also a beet kvass, which looks really nice because it's red. It's really
beautiful.
Nice. Sea salt, caraway or coriander, honey, organic ginger, and a little rye grain.
Ginger in it, huh?
Rye grain for starter, 6 cups of lukewarm water poured over 1 pound of peeled beets and left to ferment. There you go. And see, that's the reason we have pictures in the cookbook. You go, oh, that's pretty, yes. And end up with this bottle of sour stuff that it's really nice to add to things. So kvass, that's K-V-A-S. Kvass.
I think one of the things that attracted Lana and I, we actually bought these books about a month or two. It was way before the Ukrainian war started, but because there were so many fermented things, and we're kind of like, you know, Lana's picking seeds for the garden and starting seeds, and we're thinking, oh, look at this recipe. Well, we can try that this summer. And she's got a black currant vodka recipe in here, which is really simple. And now I have a black currant bush, and I love black currants. You just take the black currants and some sugar and some vodka. I'm going to make mine not too sweet, but it's basically you're just macerating the currants till it's infused into the vodka, and then you strain it off and store it away. But there's so many interesting what got us really started. And I know we've mentioned this before, the tomatoes, the pickled tomatoes. In the Mamushka book, she has 3 kinds of pickled tomatoes. She has a fermented tomato, which is I think you cut them in half. And she has a lick your fingers. We talked about the pickled tomatoes, mm-hmm. which just astounded me. We bought some at the Eastern European store in Des Moines. And so now we're going to make our own pickled tomatoes this summer. And then another one, a fermented tomato passata. And then in Lana's book, another one, what's that one? It's like a
fermented tomato pulp. There you go.
So they use the fermentation instead of canning.
Yes. Here's a note. From the author from the Summer Kitchen book. The beginning of autumn always signaled it was time to preserve and let things go sour, as we say in Ukraine. Buckets of sweet tomatoes, cucumbers, apples, plums, apricots were brought in through the lace-curtained doorway into the summer kitchen. We children would sit on stumpy wooden stools and pick out bruised and blemished. Only the best, undamaged specimens were made into the preserving jars.
Right, because you want to keep the bacteria count down. Right. Yeah.
We'll take a little break here and mention that this is KHOY. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the Heart of Iowa.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking about food from Ukraine. And my goodness, remember, lots of people there, lots of farms, lots of really good soil. They eat well. We've got two books that we're talking about, Mamushka and Summer Kitchen by author Olya Herkulis. And there's some fun stuff in here.
I think one of the things that is attractive to me is the ingredients they use are really all things that are pretty much available here in Iowa, but with different kinds of usages that we haven't explored too much. I mean, as I'm reading this book, I'm thinking, oh, we can do that this summer. Oh, let's try this, that summer. Now, I found this other thing. She has a list of some useful ingredients, and here she lists horseradish leaves, blackcurrant leaves, dill heads, and sour cherry leaves. She says these first three ingredients are typical flavorings used in pickling in Eastern Europe, while sour cherry leaves as well as horseradish leaves have tannins, so they help to keep your pickles crunchy. Now, I got really excited by that because I have in my garden already blackcurrant leaves, horseradish leaves, which I would encourage anybody to plant horseradish. I planted it just because it's a beautiful, big-leafed, kind of curly, fluffy. It's beautiful in the garden. It goes about, 24 inches. It's just a pretty green plant all summer long. And I have a sour cherry tree, which means we've got this already for the picking. And they use a lot of herbs, lots of dill, of course, and lots of garlic, lots of pork. Lots of tomatoes and most of the produce that we already grow here in Iowa. There's, like in this book, there's recipes for corn polenta and there's a recipe for, the polenta recipe is just like you would think it is, the same thing. And then they just top it with fried bits of pork fat and salty sheep's cheese. Well, we can get feta around here. So, and the other thing, Lana, we were reading about, there's something called sallow. Okay, she calls it Ukrainian narcotics. She said, I'm not even joking. The expats from Ukraine have been known to smuggle kilos of this in their suitcases when immigrating or visiting friends in America. I'm not revealing any names, because obviously it is very illegal to transport meat products. It is happily eaten straight from the freezer, thin sliced and gently balanced over some warm rye bread. Sallow, vodka, raw garlic, tomatoes, and some gherkins were offered to my friend Tom by my father at 4:30 a.m. in a frostbitten field just as they went wild goose hunting. Tom said he had never had a better breakfast. So basically, sallow is the pork belly, and you kind of wrap it up in salt and raw garlic, and you just put it in the freezer. Well, you put it in the refrigerator for a while, let it cure. Then you wash the salt off, and then you put it in the freezer. It's like the lardo tradition of Italy. Think of it as pork butter, like a seasoned pork butter.
That sounds pretty good.
Yeah. We will be trying that one. We've got all those ingredients.
I can't imagine smuggling it in your luggage. I mean, where are those airport
dogs? Where are those sniffer dogs?
Sniffer dogs. I don't know. It wouldn't make it. Something else I want to share. We just got all excited about this, too. Pickled watermelons.
Now, oh, golly. This is...
Now, I come from a tradition, and it's a German recipe, probably, or Northern European. I've pickled a watermelon rind in my day.
Yeah.
Yes, we pickled watermelon rind. No. I turned to the page for pickled watermelons, and we've got like half a watermelon at a time pickled. Or there's a recipe for pickled watermelon, and it's got a picture of the red watermelon, and you eat that. But get this, whole watermelons, as in whole, round, uncut, fermented watermelons.
In salt water, right? Is that right?
Yeah, Ukrainians will ferment anything, and watermelons are no exceptions. The author of this cookbook says when she was growing up, My mom remembers an old defunct bathtub that lived in the shady part of the garden, and they used that to pickle their watermelons. Here's a recipe. And think of a huge, huge, huge container with watermelons.
Yeah, but their watermelons look more like the size that we grow. Not the big ones that you buy at the store that's come from Texas, but the ones you get at the farmer's market, because we have a short melon season here. You know, so maybe the size of a soccer ball at the most, right?
Yeah, there you go. So you need 10 tablespoons of sea salt, 5 watermelons, about 6 inches in diameter, not bigger, so, and then some extra for juice. Then a 1/2 cup of organic whole grain rye flour. That probably helps the fermentation.
Yeah.
2 branches of sour cherry, blackcurrant, or oak leaves.
Oak leaves, too.
Then submerge all of this and pierce the watermelons all over with a metal skewer. And then you put it in a big container. Fermentation will take at least 40 days. So this is a long-term process. Very good. I like this. I mean, just think of all the fun stuff that can be done. And if you're doing this in a summer kitchen, it probably wouldn't be as messy as if you were doing it in your kitchen.
Yeah, or in the backyard.
I mean,
there must be some way you can control the bacterial growth in that. What does she say? Do you have to change the water, or do you cover it?
I think you just stand back is what you do, because I'm sure fermenting doesn't always go as planned, but my goodness, how
well,
nice.
And you just hope the chipmunks don't fall into it, right?
That's true. I want to share a idea for a soup recipe that I ran across here. It's called mushroom broth with sour pickle. Now, this is a mushroom-based vegetable soup, but also the tradition of meat-based soups. This works just as well for the meat-based soup, too. But interesting thing happens at the end.
So it's a borscht.
Well, yeah.
Kinda.
Pretty much, yeah. This one starts with a lot of wild mushrooms and hot water, barley, onions, potatoes, butter, vegetables, all kinds of vegetables, vegetable oil, parsnip, celery root, garlic cloves. Now, you make soup, but you are also cutting up 5 cucumber, fermented cucumbers, so 5 pickles, and then at the end, you add 1 to 1 1/4 to 2 cups brine from quick fermented cucumbers or pickle juice from a jar. Kind of a sweet and sour soup.
Adding the sauerkraut
adding
juice.
Sour.
To, right. At the end.
Yeah,
you don't
at
want
the
your,
end, yeah.
yeah.
So.
Now, the other thing they do is, well, I have to say, Lana and I have been growing kefir for, oh, golly, I don't know.
Ever since you gave me a starter.
At least 8 years, probably. We keep it going. Sometimes it gets spoiled, and then I have to start over. Because Lana's always is perfect. I don't know how. But I have to tell you that the culture for this kefir was smuggled into the country by one of our Ukrainian neighbors. So what we're doing, the kefir culture that we are working with, was originally from the Ukraine. And I have used the kefir culture, which is I call it the blob. It's kind of just a little congealed mess. I like making kefir because it's easier than making homemade yogurt because you can do it at room temperature. Now, sometimes in the colder part of the year, it takes longer for it to sour because it's slower. But I have made my own basically either cream fraiche or sour cream, whatever you want to call it, by taking heavy cream, like a quart of heavy cream, putting the kefir blob into it and letting it ferment. And oh, that is the most delicious thing. And it's something, she has something like that, similar, I've forgotten what the Ukrainian.
How long do you let it ferment? Overnight?
The cream goes as fast as the kefir does. It's the same, it's just a higher butterfat content.
Okay. Not long, folks.
No,
not long.
In the summer, it can take 24 hours. In the winter, sometimes it's a day and a half or more, depending on, you know, how cold the kitchen gets at night. I just put it in a quart jar, clean, sterilized quart jar. I pour the milk or cream in, and then I put the kefir blob in, and then I put an upside down teacup over the top, and I just let it sit till it thickens, and then you put it in the fridge, which kind of slows the fermentation down. But that is what a lot of the topping, it's used a lot in the recipes, on dumplings, on soups, in desserts.
And when we say kefir blob, I don't think, is blob the technical term?
No.
It's grains or?
Yeah, right. Kefir grains it's called, looks, but that's a,
yeah.
It doesn't look like grain.
It looks more like tapioca or teeny tiny.
Like it's a gelatinous, clearish kind of.
Cottage cheese-ish.
Yes, yes.
It's a little hard nobule in there. Mm-hmm. You'll find it.
Mm-hmm.
What a good invention. Thank you for turning me on to kefir, Donna.
Yeah, we've been doing this Ukrainian thing for years and didn't even think about it. Because it is so easy to do these things in Iowa. The climate similarities are amazing.
You mentioned dumplings.
Oh, yes.
I think dumplings are lovely. Here is a little bit on dumplings. Vernicke, which is, my pronunciation probably isn't right, but that's what the title of this chapter is. Vernicke, which is the Ukrainian word for dumpling. In Poland, pierogi is something here, but this is which is kind of the same thing. But you always have to call it whatever your grandmother called it, and there it is. The author contemplates what her death row dish might be, and she decided that her mother's Vernicke dumplings, stuffed dumplings that take their name from veriti, to boil. The cook makes a dough from white flour, egg, and water, and then rolls it out very thin by hand. And for the filling, she seasons homemade curd cheese heavily with salt and whisks in an egg yolk or two. The dough is then cut into squares before being filled and sealed to make a delicate triangular dumpling, boiled briefly in salt water and dropped into a well of melted butter in a bowl. They are served with cool sour cream. Slip them into your mouth.
More sour cream,
And the author confesses that once she ate 50 at one sitting.
Woo!
Well, I mean, these are small, but I could see, like, I think they'd go down pretty well, Donna.
Well, in the Mamushka book, she has in the dessert section, she's calling it a steamed pasta with strawberries, but basically it's a dough, and she makes the dumpling, and she puts the strawberries in the middle, and she said, we normally boil these where I come from, but I much prefer this steamed recipe from Poltava, Central Ukraine, which I started using a few years ago. These are so superb with fresh sour cherries or blackberries or apricots or strawberries. And it's the same thing. You just make the dumpling, and it's a little round cut up, and you fold it over a few slices of strawberry, you know, pinch it shut, and then steam it, and then serve it with, guess what? Maple syrup, honey, some sweetening, and you can put sour cream on it. Go figure.
I like that. Yes, I've been thinking about connections that we have to the Ukraine, and everybody knows somebody, I have people that I've known in the past that either they came from Ukraine or their parents did. We had a volunteer at our farm. Oh, quite a few years ago now, a young woman from the Ukraine was here working at the university, and her father came to visit. And he spoke not a word of English, and he was driving his daughter absolutely nuts with nothing to do in this Iowa town. And she said, could my father come out and help you a little bit in the field? And I thought, oh, sure. She will put up a chair for him or something. That'll be fine. This man shows up. His name was Orst. And I remember Orst as one of the hardest workers. He was not a stranger to work in the field. He helped us with the garlic harvest. He did many, many things for us. And at the end of each day, of work in the field, he'd stand under the hose himself off, and gratefully take, since I didn't know, I couldn't say too much to him, I didn't know what I should give him as a treat afterwards, and so I carried a glass of lemonade and a beer out to them, and he took both, and he said, thank you, and downed them both. And I often think of Orst, especially during garlic season. Yes, yes.
But my Ukrainian neighbors, the one that gave us the kefir culture, also their parents came to visit and stayed. You know, you don't come from the Ukraine to visit your children and stay 3 days. You know, you stay months, right? And so as a result of the parents coming, they have a large garden. Of course, half the backyard has been turned into lots of, plenty of tomatoes and cucumbers for pickling and things like that. And it's good to see that it's still in their tradition that they do keep gardens and feed themselves from the gardens.
Very good. After all, that good soil, and we can use our good soil, too, for gardens. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen, KHOI Community Radio. Find out more at khoifm.org. Welcome back. I was looking for some music from Eastern Europe, and this one seemed a pretty thing to share. It's a blessing. It's a wish for God to bless Estonia. Estonia is a bit of north of Ukraine, but
the Baltic.
It's up in the Baltic, but it's pretty up there. Yes, it is.
I fell down the YouTube rabbit hole the other night looking up Eastern European music, and it started with, do you remember when the Bulgarian women's choir was really popular? So beautiful. I love that. So I kind of tracked it down on YouTube to listen to it again, and then that led to there was a Lithuanian, the Forest Singers, with a whole video of them singing, saluting the oak trees and this and that. And the music is just, it's so beautiful.
Yeah, I went to a Lithuanian choir concert right here in Ames, Iowa quite a few years ago, and it was in a church. It was lovely, and it was a lovely choir, and we got to speak a little bit to the people afterwards at a little reception, and we realized that singing in Lithuania is kind of like a sport. It's like everyone joins, and it's a big deal. Choir singing is an amazing thing. So that's good. Oh, you've got another, that looks like a good recipe over there.
Well,
Donna, why don't you say something?
This is called, she calls it an Azerbaijani chicken with prunes and walnuts. Now, I have to say, when I was cooking for Norman Lear, there was a recipe that he didn't often request something. So if Norman asked for it, I just did it. He wanted chicken and prunes. And so this is a very Yiddish kind of thing. And of course, a lot of the Jewish recipes are Eastern European. You think of the Russian Jews, the German Jews, and, you know, all of these cuisines are all mixed in together. So and Gio, our Georgian friend, is always talking about cooking with plums, of course, which is what a dried prune is. So here's what Mamalushka, it says, oh, how they love walnuts in the Caucasus, and how they love their, I don't know how you pronounce this, Alycha, plums, which are turned into lovely sour sauce. She says prunes will never be the perfect match. They are too sweet. And hence she adds lemon. But this is a roast chicken. I mean, so you stuff the inside of the chicken. And she said stuffing fish too is an old tradition. And you add some spices to the stuffing and it will be very festive. So this chicken is stuffed with ground sumac, pitted prunes finely chopped, grated rind and juice of one lemon, walnuts toasted and roughly chopped, one red onion grated, sea salt and ground black pepper. And then you just stuff the inside of the chicken with that. You truss it. And then on the outside you put, you know, salt and pepper and more sumac. And then you just roast it. I'm going to try this one.
See, I think we get too timid with things here. I mean, there's a lot of things. I figure, boy, I'm really pushing it. If I squirt a little lemon juice on my chicken, I think, oh, that's something. But good heavens,
and
look,
it's not complicated.
No, more and stuff prunes. How nice.
Well, and I'm glad she talked about it because Gio is always he keeps you know, he wants to do these prune sauces and prune things that are very Georgian. And our prunes are, as she says, are too sweet. So they're not an equivalent substitute. However, when this summer comes, we're going to go after Helen Gunderson's. I hope she gets some damson plums for us. Because apparently if you pick them just before they're super juicy ripe, you get the sour plum that you need.
Oh, Donna, you're kind of...
We got the whole summer planned out.
Committing us to the... Actually, it sounds like a lot of fun, but my goodness, there's so many good things out there.
The possibilities are endless, you know. I mean, if we're going into World War III, we're going to go in style, and we're going to eat well, as long as we can.
We're going to eat. And also, I think of what's going on in Ukraine now, and when I see the news footage, I just cringe when I see tanks rolling over the big wheat field areas. I think, ooh, compaction. Ooh, this is not good. Saying nothing about what they're doing.
And there's so many. I did read an article this morning about how the museums in the Ukraine are busy stashing away and bomb-proofing as much as they can. They have hundreds of thousands of old, hand-printed manuscripts with one was said was made with gold thread and all kinds of old religious icons, priceless, irreplaceable things. They talked about in some of the their churches are those domed churches. Some of them have stained glass windows that survived World War II, and so they are covering them with metal plates.
Ooh.
I mean, really trying to protect, which is, you know, it's amazing that they can do that while they're busy trying to protect human life, you know.
My goodness.
But culture is important.
One of these days, I have hope. I really do have hope that we will have moved beyond this sort of silliness and we get back to stuffing our chickens with prunes. Now, that's the important thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
For goodness sake, that's, everybody needs a good meal.
Yeah, it's time for world peas, as Ben and Jerry used to say.
Thank you. Very good. I want to read a little bit here. I mentioned before about a masonry oven. Here's a little bit from the book Summer Kitchens. Long before kerosene and gas stoves became popular in Ukraine, there was an oven that was more than an oven, called a Peach, P-I-C-H. In Ukraine, this substantial masonry oven would be built into the structure of a house. A proper oven like this would be crafted by an expert mason, a trade that has almost died out now. You had to sign up well in advance for your Peach to be built and wait your turn. Such an oven also featured into some summer kitchens, especially those that were originally used as an interim accommodation while the main house was being constructed. I also want to...
You know, I think those are... You see Swedish old homes and all kinds of Nordic homes have these these mason ovens, too. They're quite beautiful.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's not like a wood stove that you can pick up and move somewhere. It's built into the part of the house.
These are for houses that are going to stay there. And here's a little bit more about The summer kitchen. The summer kitchens are the place, like I said, are not necessarily just summer, but it's a place where a lot of food happens. And these are summer kitchen memories that are sent in by women who no longer live in the Ukraine, but sent in to be part of this book. And this is a woman who lives in the UK now, but used to live in the Donetsk region of Ukraine, around the flat steppes, southeastern Ukraine. Here she's writing about her grandmother's summer kitchen. The summer kitchen was next to the main house, across the yard, made out of clay and built around a wood-fired pitch oven. It was mainly used for cooking in the summer, but my grandmother also used the wood fire during the winter. Lots of shelves lining the wall where plates were kept, with curtains drawn over them instead of wooden doors. My babushka Lina had dried corn hanging from the ceiling, and she kept various preserves in tins, including dried chicken stomachs that she said would cure our tummy aches. She also kept a dried snakeskin in a jar as a superstition. If you found a snakeskin in the woods, it would bring you good luck. In the kitchen garden, there grew onions, potatoes, beans, tomatoes, cucumbers, apples, strawberries, raspberries, black currants, and we preserved the berries and apples by making them into jams. She would kill a pig every year in the winter when the weather was cold so the meat wouldn't spoil. We would make sausages, including blood sausages and preserved meat. I look back on the food of my childhood with great nostalgia, especially as I've had to leave the area I grew up in. Even in this globalized world, it's hard to find some of the things you used to love eating in Ukraine, especially sunflower seeds eaten straight from the shells and good dark bread. A lot of Ukrainian food was natural and less processed, and sometimes I miss that a great deal. Here's another woman writing about Ukraine, but she lives in the U.S. now. Our home region was Podilia, which is at the crossroads of western and eastern Ukraine. Summer kitchen was a solid brick building next to the main house. It had three rooms with separate entrances. The large room was a kitchen, had a gas stove with a big red gas tank next to it, and a masonry oven. In theory, you could sleep on the masonry oven if you wanted to. In her summer kitchen, Grandma also kept years and years worth of Pepper, an old Ukrainian satirical magazine, and I enjoyed looking at them. Next to the summer kitchen was a chicken coop and a fenced chicken run, so my grandmother always had fresh eggs. On special occasions, a chicken would be killed, and we had the most delicious chicken noodle soup. I could eat all of this stuff again and again. Grandmother's strawberry preserves were also outstanding. I loved the sweet, sugary foam from the giant enamel pans, and that was a real treat. So, summer kitchens. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen.
Right, we are celebrating the food traditions of the Ukraine today.
Yes, two cookbooks, Mamushka and Summer Kitchens. Yes. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Find us here on KHOI Community Radio. We had music by Tom McKenzie. You heard March Thaw, an Estonian song, and we'll end up with a Norwegian waltz. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
We had excellent engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life.